This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We should have courts that are set up specifically and equipped and staffed to hear cyber matters. I mean, the reality is quite simple. Cyber is not going to go away. It's only going to get worse.
That's Craig Pedersen, a director of TCG Forensics in Johannesburg, on the need for investigators and courts to get caught up on how cyber crimes occur. Details coming up. Also, Nigerian authorities are investigating the deaths of 15 people in the explosion of an illegally tapped oil pipeline. And Niger's defense ministry says at least 29 soldiers were killed in an attack near the border with Mali. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. Nigerian authorities are investigating the deaths of 15 people in the explosion of an illegally tapped oil pipeline in River State off the West African nation's Southern Delta region. Timothy Obiezu in Abuja examines the illegal tapping of Nigeria's oil pipelines and why, after decades, it continues to kill scores.
The River State Police Command in southern Nigeria told VOA by phone Wednesday that authorities have launched a probe into the latest incident. Spokesperson Grace Iringa-Koko said Iba community locals had been scooping crude oil and refining it at an illegal site late Sunday night when an explosion happened. She said authorities removed 15 charred bodies, including that of a pregnant woman, from the site. Authorities say 20 survivors, including the owner of the illegal refinery, were taken to a local hospital with burns.
We're investigating on it. They are these illegal refined products they were scooping that caused this fire explosion. Yes, we did it. We documented the photograph of the incident. But certainly members of the public and parents should warn their wards that they should not involve in such activities. And we're also trying to see if we can deploy more security in that place so that such acts will not continue.
Crude oil theft is a perennial problem in Nigeria, one of the Africa's largest oil producers. The illegal refining of crude oil, known as oil bunkering, is rampant in oil-rich regions. In April, the Nigerian Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative said Nigeria lost about 620 million barrels of crude oil, valued at $46 billion between 2009 and 2020. Nigerian authorities have been trying to address the problem without much success. Faith Nwadishi, executive director of the Center for Transparency Advocacy, says authorities must take decisive security and legal action to end oil theft.
The technology around refining of crude, whether is not what the local people themselves are involved in, is a cabal of very knowledgeable people with resources that are able to do that. So government really needs to look inward. The issues around impunity and corruption, our legal framework is weak. We don't have strong management, and we also don't have strong justice systems that will help to bring people to book.
Nigeria is dependent on crude oil for more than 80% of its national revenue. Authorities say oil theft is detrimental to Nigeria's economy and national security. But Nwadishi says widespread poverty and hardships in oil-producing regions also play a role.
Over the years that we have implemented or taken crude from these communities, there has been little or no development that has happened. Meanwhile, those same communities, you don't have projects, you don't have infrastructure, the people don't have electricity. They are just every day they are faced with the issues about degradation that comes from oil production within their communities. So people around communities now see it as a right to take part of this crude.
Oil and gas expert Emmanuel Afimia says without better opportunities for locals, it will be difficult to tackle oil theft.
Many of these villages that are along the pipeline, many of them know about these illegal refineries. But as long as the money keeps flowing into the owners' pockets and then it keeps circulating in the communities, then they would not want to rat out whoever is operating that particular structure. So having to depend on communities to report people or report structures might not work.
The UN says stolen oil worldwide accounts for around 5 to 7% of the global crude oil and petroleum fuel market. Last year, Nigeria awarded a pipeline surveillance contract to former militant government Ekpomupolo, also known as Tompolo, and uncovered many large sites where oil was being siphoned. But experts say unless the deeper problem of corruption is solved or authorities begin to prosecute offenders, oil theft will continue to be a problem in Nigeria. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
The High State Council in Libya has called for an international investigation into last month's flood disaster in the eastern city of Derna, but Libya's Attorney General Ali Siddiq Al-Sor says there is no need for it. Claudia Gazzini, Libya's senior analyst at the International Crisis Group, told VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi there is a real need for an international probe.
I think it's very much needed, whether international or just simply independent, a mix of Libyan and international experts. It has to be a technical committee. It's very much needed because none of Libya's institutions has the credibility, the trust of the people, and I must say also the ability to carry out a thorough investigation on the matter. So I very much hope that all parties will agree to this. And I hope there can be also international backing of the Security Council to make this possible. Libyans need answers. They deserve answers. And I think we need to, and the world need answers, because this creates a precedent, creates problems for other countries where dam and strategic infrastructure is at risk of this changing climate and these major violent downpours. So I can only hope that this will materialize.
But some analysts say, while it makes sense that those with immediate responsibility for the Derna dams would be arrested, the fact that so far at least no national-level officials have been arrested suggests that the Attorney General will seek to scapegoat these local officials as the ones primarily responsible for the disaster. Do you agree with that?
I beg to differ. I mean, I don't think it makes sense to arrest the little bureaucrat who is, you know, overseeing the dam for this tragedy. Again, I repeat, the story is much more complex. I have to explain one point, Mohammed, which is that these dams were not operating dams. For the past 20 years, they were not being used to retain water. The valley behind them has always been dry. Water is flowing through the dam. So they're not active dams as you might imagine them in the West. And so it seems to me that the responsibility is much broader, that it's, you can't really pin it down to one specific individual. And blaming the local desk clerk who is in charge of, you know, overseeing these dams, which I repeat, were not really active, seems like a very quick way to, please people, but is far from obtaining the truth. I would like to see investigations, people being questioned, and then arrest, not in this upside down system that Libya has, which is to immediately arrest people and then start asking questions.
Finally, would the Derna investigation contribute to unify Libya or widen the current division?
The political process in Libya, I think, is to remain frozen for a while, meaning that the Derna tragedy brought people together, brought some form of under-the-table cooperation between the two governments, but is unlikely to kickstart a real political track that will lead to a political reunification of this divided country. Unfortunately, I think this is the case.
That was Claudia Gazzini, Libya senior analyst at the International Crisis Group, speaking with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. In late July, Ghana's parliament voted to make it a crime to accuse a person of witchcraft. If the president signs the bill into law, it will also force the closure of camps where hundreds of accused witches live in exile. Hamza Adams has the report, narrated by Grace Oyonobi.
Every morning, Fatima comes to this camp to help her mother with chores. Her mother has lived here for 5 years, forced to flee her home after being accused of witchcraft. Fatima, who also goes by her first name, says her mother was accused of witchcraft in a part of northern Ghana where traditional beliefs are deeply rooted. But Fatima says her mother can't go back to her community because the stigma attached to such labels is hard to shake off.
It's been 5 years since traditional healers in this camp declared that my mother was not a witch. We want to take her home, but the community is unwilling to accept her. That is the reason why I came here to take care of her.
More than 500 people are living in this camp because they have been accused of witchcraft. Nearly 67% of people in the country accused of witchcraft are widows, according to a 2022 report by Songtaba, a human rights organization, and susceptible to violence. In 2020, a 90-year-old woman was beaten to death in Kafaba, in Ghana's Savannah region, over a witchcraft accusation. Amnesty International's Genevieve Partington says such attacks are not acceptable.
People feel if they accuse someone of being a witch, they can lynch them, beat them, you know, let them, submit them to all sorts of human rights abuses, and it's not right.
In July, Ghana's parliament passed a bill criminalizing the accusation of witchcraft, but the bill is still waiting for President Nana Akufo-Addo's signature. If implemented, the bill will also force the closure of camps housing accused witches across the country. Francis Kevia Sosu is a parliamentarian who moved for the passage of the bill.
At the UN level, the Human Rights Council and the periodic reviews of Ghana always made reference to issues of witchcraft and women who are left in witch camps and violated all the universal declarations on human rights.
Human rights groups in Ghana have lauded Parliament's efforts, and Amnesty's Partington says the bill also carries penalties for people who make accusations of witchcraft.
If you abuse physically, emotionally, any person or accuse them of witchcraft, you can go to jail for a period of up to 5 years. I think this is something very important.
In 2014, Ghana's government attempted to close the 6 witch camps in the country, but managed to shut down only one. Analysts hope passing the bill and closing the remaining 5 camps will end the exile and suffering of the hundreds of women accused of witchcraft. For Hamza Adam in Kumasi, Ghana, Grace Oyenubi, VOA News.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. And for more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Niger's defense ministry says at least 29 soldiers have been killed in an attack near the border with Mali during military operations aimed at neutralizing the threat posed by an Islamic State militant group in the area. And Mali's northern Tuareg rebels said yesterday they seized another military base from the Malian army after taking 4 camps in recent weeks. We have my colleague Mohamed Al-Shenawi again discussing these security developments with David Darosh, Associate Professor at the Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies.
Basically, what this does is this puts the lie to the justification for the coup. I mean, in Mali, of course, you had a desire to replace what seemed to be a relatively effective French-led counterinsurgency effort. And counterinsurgency takes a long time. It requires a lot of soldier discipline. It requires patience. You replaced it with a Wagner Group-led effort that, quite frankly, has been genocidal. It's empowered some ethnic groups and has waged war and, you know, there are documented killings of thousands of Malians who don't belong to favored groups. In Niger, we know that there is Russian support. We haven't seen the same level of Wagner involvement, but there was support again for the expulsion of the French with this idea that military men will clear things up quickly, you know, and basically apply brutality. That very rarely works. Usually that philosophy incubates insurgency. And what we've seen, particularly in Mali or with the Tuareg, who, you know, are active in eastern Mali, western Niger, they view themselves as suspect by both of those governments, and they're not going to knuckle under to that. So I think that this sort of trouble is a direct result of the poor decisions made by these military juntas. And it shows that when the military gets involved in government, you get poor government, and you also get a bad military.
So how do you explain the rise of terrorist attacks in the two countries following the two military takeover?
With one exception, Uruguay, there's never been an insurgency or a really effective terrorist movement in a country that is a democracy. In general, terrorism and insurgencies are a function of either poor government or outside support. What you have across the Sahel is poor government, you know, lack of development, high levels of corruption. And the antidote to these insurgencies is a combination of effective security actions, but not indiscriminate security actions like you're seeing with the Wagner Group in Mali, and enhanced government that provides services and democratic accountability. With these coups, you've got exactly the opposite in the name of security. You can get some short-term benefits and you can kill a lot of people, but you can't deliver governance. So unless you completely eliminate ethnically different populations where these people, where the insurgency draws its support from, you'll always have an insurgency problem. That's you know, military theory and political science theory all agree on that. So the violence we're seeing is a direct result of the ineffectiveness of military rule, particularly in a country where the militaries, quite frankly, are not very good.
Following the withdrawal of the UN from Mali and then the French troops from Niger, the United States still maintains around 1,000 troops in Niger and a base for drones. Could the U.S. fill the current gap in Sahel counterterrorism?
I don't think so. I mean, we can provide key enabling, we can provide observation. But again, at the end of the day, this counterterrorism effort has to be conducted with the support of local populations. And if you have what are basically despotic rule, generally by people who are drawn from one ethnic group in a multinational, multi-ethnic nation, you're always going to have some sort of problem. You're always going to have some form of political violence. And the United States, with the small number of forces we have committed there, we can move against certain high-value targets. We can move against organizations that are moving transnationally. But at the end of the day, the insurgency will draw its support from people who view their government as oppressive. And that's a function of governance that the United States can't impose.
That was David Darosh, Associate Professor at the Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA's Mohamed Al-Shenawi. Security analysts say cyber criminals based in South Africa are increasingly targeting victims in Africa and around the world. According to the investigators, the criminals are targeting Africa's stronger economies, including Ethiopia, Kenya, and South Africa itself, but also West Africa, Europe, and the United States. Darren Taylor reports.
International anti-crime groups like Interpol say global cybercrime gangs, including Nigeria's Black Axe, have long used South Africa as a base from which to defraud people around the world. Black Axe has, for example, stolen hundreds of millions of dollars from women, many in the United States, using online romance scams. Director of TCG Forensics in Johannesburg, Craig Pedersen, says South Africa's undoubtedly Africa's cybercrime capital. He says cyber criminals, from large organizations to individuals operating from dingy internet cafes, are taking advantage of South Africa's good telecoms infrastructure. Another plus for perpetrators, says Pedersen, is the country's sophisticated financial and banking systems, offering the criminals speedy highways to move money wherever they want.
Cybercrime is one of those crimes that is scalable. If you're going to scam one person, you may as well scam 10. It's the same amount of work. If you're going to do one invoice interception, you may as well do 10 or 20, same amount of work. We're really struggling with the volumes in South Africa in terms of how many victims are coming forward and reporting crimes on a daily basis.
Wendy Nola, a journalist investigating cybercrime, says a current favorite of South Africa-based online scammers is to set up fake websites. She says the criminals use these to steal money from international online shoppers.
They will just Google a particular brand of sneakers, say, or trainers, maybe add the city that they're in. They'll get a result. They'll get a few results. And they click on and they start looking at the lovely merchandise. And usually the price is good. There's a sale. And they click, they pay, and then they don't get the goods. They're not checking the URL. They're not looking to see if their contact details are not thinking about, what if I need to contact this company? If something goes wrong, can I contact them? It's just instant gratification, sort of not.
Pedersen's traced victims across the continent from Egypt to Ethiopia, Nigeria to Kenya. He says cyber criminal networks have many interlinked bank accounts, so it's very difficult for banks to detect suspicious activity, simply because it isn't suspicious, because it involves small amounts of money. He says the criminals operate with relative impunity because South African law enforcement doesn't have the technical capacity to investigate cybercrime.
We've got the court system that also needs to play catch up and start getting more automated in our courtrooms. We should have dedicated cyber courts. We should have courts that are set up specifically and equipped and staffed to hear cyber matters. I mean, the reality is quite simple. Cyber is not going to go away. It's only going to get worse.
But in a country where a judicial system battles huge backlogs of cases involving multiple murders, Pedersen acknowledges that for the moment, this is wishful thinking. According to an Interpol report, there were 230 million cyber threats detected in South Africa in 2021, the most on the continent. Pedersen says this number is now likely much higher. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Hundreds of students, researchers, and artists planning to study in France are uncertain about visas due to deteriorating relations with Paris following coups in Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger over the past 3 years. French relations with some West African states have turned bitter, prompting Paris to close its consular services in the three countries due to security concerns and to suspend development aid and cooperation. French President Emmanuel Macron is seeking to reset ties with its former colonies in Africa amid competition for influence from Russia and China. But the juntas that seized power have turned against France, kicking out its troops and ambassadors amid growing anti-French sentiment. Critics of France say it has sought to maintain excessive economic and political influence decades after the country's gained independence. France says it has moved away from that kind of a dynamic. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Nabil Biagio, and our engineer, Shogun Chong, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.